Welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm Thomas Waymont.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Well, it's almost Christmas Eve, and so it was going to be fun to talk to Dr. Thomas Waymont. We'll talk about some of the Christmas legends associated with Jesus. Did Herod really kill a bunch of babies? We'll also talk about the wise men. Were they revered or viewed with suspicion by the ancient Jews? Check out a conversation. Let's move on to Herod for a second, because I've heard that there is no historical evidence for this massacre of the innocents, I think.
Yeah,
some
we like
others.
To call it that.
Yeah, the killing everybody under two.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What do you think of that?
I've heard it taught in a history class. I've heard it taught on Sunday school. I've heard it talked about in popularly, and there's always a surprise by the Sunday school crowd that, as you said it, why doesn't this crop up in Tacitus or Suetonius or some of our other historians? And the scholarly community is perhaps would note, I would be surprised if it did. We're talking about a very small village, 200 to 300 people. And I don't want to minimize this. I want to be really careful that anybody listening understands. I am not trying to say it's not a big deal that one or two babies passed away. But one or two babies passing away in a pogrom or this kind of search to get Jesus wouldn't typically appear in a historical source. So it's not unbelievable, but it's not quite the divide that some crowds make it.
You think it's as small as one or two babies? Because I always thought it was like hundreds of babies that were killed under the age of two.
No. This is a very small area. We're talking Bethlehem,
okay. And
we're talking a rural village. And we just don't have population density. Jesus' hometown of Nazareth has been estimated to be under 300 people. Bethlehem is not a large city. Even in the modern world, this is a very small village. Almost everybody in that city is going to know one another. Highly likely that a large population of the city is related to one another. And so we're not talking... And our videos do this to us. Walking through the streets, tearing people out of their homes, finding their babies. This is going to a really small town in southern Idaho, rural Utah, and everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows the Romans are coming, and everybody knows they're after the babies, and we're talking a few people, 2, 3, but I don't want to minimize those deaths.
No, I understand. Yeah. But yeah, so if it was just a small, like, so you're telling me that Herod would have gone to, and was it Bethlehem or was it Nazareth? I think that's another great question.
It is, right, Matthew.
Or Jerusalem, as the
disagree.
Book of Mormon says.
Yeah, right. But if it's in Bethlehem, assuming that's the likely place where this took place, this is a small region. Herod doesn't even bother to go. That's peculiar in the story. I mean, just, hey, go over and see if you can find him. He's not too bothered by it. This is something, you know, subordinates can carry out. And he doesn't ever, or Matthew doesn't ever comment that Herod was angry that he didn't get the baby. Matthew leaves it as though Herod assumed, hey, I got it. I've got this taken care of.
Okay, so the wise men come to Herod. Where's the king of the Jews that was just born? Herod's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Go look for him.
Kill him.
Yeah, well, then
the
supposedly
the
he kills him.
The king of the Jews.
Okay.
Yes.
And so, but this is not a big, massive slaughter. It's a couple of babies at most. Is that the best way to describe
it? Yeah.
Okay, so that's not anything that we would normally see in the history books.
Right, and I think it places a little bit undue burden to say this should be in history books.
For
a Christian believer, it's a big deal, but for a historical event, this is a small deal.
Now, and I'll reference that video again. One of the things that they brought up was, you know, these wise men came from the East. And I know there are a lot of legends of different wise men. In the video, one of the things they said was they believed that they were from Iran, or what we would call Iran today, Zoroastrians. Yes. I've also heard they were from China. I've heard their bones are in
Köln, Germany.
I've heard their bones are in Iran.
That might be. I've been to the Köln Cathedral.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they're in Iran as well.
Yeah. And in the video that I saw, these and I'm just going to call them Iranians, Zoroastrians, whatever. Mm-hmm. I can't even say that word.
Sure.
But the video that I saw said that, hey, these are people. These are people that came from our enemy, Persia, and that Persia and Rome were enemies, essentially. And yeah. so Herod was greatly troubled. Hmm. So what do you think of that?
That's a really fascinating insight. The reason that they're, to back up just a little bit, give everybody here a couple thoughts to work on. The reason that we think they're Zoroastrian is that word Magoi does appear in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and it refers to people from that area. And the fact that we are calling them Magoi, magicians is the modern word, but we favor wise men, is not a positive term. So the modern reader sees these as a positive moment in the story, but if they were appearing in Jeremiah, who uses the word, I believe it's Jeremiah, he uses it very negatively. That these are people that are kind of outside of Israel, they're condemned, etc. And so that's one dynamic in the story. We're bringing these older outsiders in. Second thing is true that Israel, Galilee, exist on the border of the Roman Empire. So people crossing that border could theoretically be viewed as threatening, which it sounds like. And I don't remember hearing that in that, but the idea that they're crossing this border being a threat, possibly, I would say. I that does work on a historical level. I wouldn't push back against it. I don't know that Matthew uses that productively to heighten the idea of threat. He doesn't lash out at them. He lashes out at their message.
Yeah, the video that I saw said that Herod would be bothered by this more than, say, Matthew, I think.
Sure. And that would theoretically be true because he's guaranteeing to Rome that he's maintaining the peace.
Okay.
And so, yes, you know, it's strange. A lot of things are strange in that story in the sense of the way the star acts. You know, if just as a modern reader, the star leads them to Jerusalem, however that happens, and then it waits for them. And then they go in and talk to Herod, and they come back out, and the star's still there, and then it takes them in another direction. It does a complete left turn. So if you're physically in that city, they've come from the east, they've arrived at the western city of Jerusalem. It says, hey, wait for me. We're going to go in and talk to Herod. Herod says he's in Bethlehem. They have to do an exact 90-degree left turn. They go down to Bethlehem. And then the star picks up again and says, here's the home. So, yeah, for Matthew, the star is part of it as sign, but he doesn't seem to work through the logic of why that sign was as important in the story.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Do you have any other ideas on this idea of where the wise men came from? Like I said, I've heard some say it came from China. I've heard some where it was like Africa, which isn't really east, but it was a black guy, a white guy, and a Indian guy, I think.
Sure.
So kind of good, nice diversity sort of thing.
Yeah. No, I like I said, I several years ago had the opportunity to be in Germany, and one of the things I wanted to do is see one of their final resting places, and they have their names, you know, Melchior, Balthazar, and Gaspar, yeah. And that was a fun day, and
yeah.
But I've heard scholars remark that if we put all of their different tombs, I think we have, you know, like 18 wise men or something out there, and then so as a scholar of history, I kind of look at it that way. Oh, this is a fun story, and I don't probably have anything really meaningful to add to that.
Okay, so you don't know where they came from, essentially.
Yeah, it's a scholarly black hole. You know, I could jump in there, but there's no guidelines that could guide what I would say. So okay. I feel like I get
so they're just mystery men as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, they're magicians. Yeah, to me. Yeah.
So, I've heard some people say that they were astrologers. You know, we think of astrology today as, you know, Gene Dixon and weird, you know, crystal balls things. Was that the same sort of a thing back then?
Not quite. There are people, we do have quite a bit of evidence of people that have this sense of the sky as map, where the sky has regions. And this is not my expertise, so I might misspeak here, but to the best of my understanding is the whole sky represents a map, a celestial map, and a new star appearing in a quadrant could be something that triggered their understanding. So that's not quite the same as reading a palm or a tarot card. But if the idea that you've thought of, you know, here in Ursa Minor or you know, the Milky Way band or something, and that represents the Western Mediterranean or the Eastern, and the new star appears in there, then you know some activities happening in that region. But you can see from the modern parallel, what does that mean, right? I see a new star. If my wife took me outside and said, hey, there's a new star, I'd say, oh, great. I don't know what to make of it. And I think we place a lot on our Book of Mormon background there, because there's meaning given to it. It's owned by a prophet. It's a declaration. It tells you something. We have none of that in the New Testament. Matthew doesn't tell you what it means. He doesn't say, hey, one of the prophets spoke about this. To him, it's like the birth of an emperor. A new star appeared, or signs in heaven. That's very common in Roman kind of logic, to say a great person was born today, this happened, earthquake, etc.
Interesting. Are there any other parts of the Christmas story that we haven't brought out yet?
You know, there's one I always find fascinating. I've talked about this a lot to different audiences over time, and it always surprises me that this surprises audiences, but there are no donkeys in the story. Every pageant we have has Mary and Joseph, and Joseph walking alongside this donkey with Mary 8 or 9 or 7 months pregnant. It's a beautiful image, right? It does well in art, but there are none of those references. So we fabricated. You asked earlier, where are these stories fabricated? That's the modern reader doing that. And Joseph is wonderfully kind. And the ancients, they engage this story differently. They don't put the animals in. They're dealing with Joseph's age. So there's early Christian tradition that this is Joseph's second marriage, and he has older children already. And so you'll see early Christians debating, is he an older man? And then the other side of it is, if they are first marriage, are they both teenagers? And so that's a really different image than our wonderfully kind of modern people wearing these beautifully clean clothes, riding a donkey 93 miles roughly to have their baby. That's a modern myth a bit.
And oh, wow.
Maybe they did. Maybe they rented a donkey. Maybe Joseph owned one. Maybe they got in the back of a wagon. But for heaven's sakes, they might have walked.
They had rent-a-donkeys like rent-a-cars back then?
Sure. I mean, sure. Yeah, we have to ask that question. I don't think the modern reader realizes that when you make your stable, your nativity, and we start throwing things like cows and you know, all kinds of big animals, bovine, and we're making a very wealthy family in a manger. That's a peculiar image. You know, every animal you add, and there's a lot of people in the primary, so you got to give them all roles. But, right, the reality is you make them rich in a manger. You give them a donkey and you make them wealthy, but then they can't get there otherwise. And there's all of these contrasts in the modern world that the ancient world would have picked up on.
So would a donkey be considered a person who owned a donkey would be considered wealthy?
Coming from an agricultural area like Joseph, where vineyard viticulture is what they're doing in Nazareth, yes, it's out of the ordinary.
Oh, wow.
Now, not rich, but let's say doing fairly well.
Middle class.
Yeah.
Not poor.
Sure, we can throw them in that middling group is what scholars call it. But yes, why would a person who does viticulture have a donkey to begin with? That's what they do in Nazareth. So, yeah, I'm not sure he had one, but maybe he rented one. And whatever there is, you know, right? He would have been kind. I've heard people come up to me and say after a presentation, you know, Joseph would have been kind. Sure, I bet he would have, to be honest.
Kind doesn't get you a car.
Right, right.
Or a donkey.
You still have to put it on your credit card.
Exactly.
So, yeah, yeah. So I'm always surprised at that reaction. I guess as a scholar, I don't want to put new things in the story to help it meet my sensitivities. I'm more confronted by the scarcity of the image that that they portray. They're compelled, they're forced to go down there. They go. Luke immediately says, and upon their arrival, she goes into labor. That sounds like it was harsh. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it was causative. And so there are different dynamics that he's telling that I think the modern reader misses.
Well, that's very interesting. And I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Thomas Waymet. In our next conversation, we'll jump back to Jeff Chadwick. Are there ancient texts that used to refer to Bethlehem as being at Jerusalem?
One of the El Amarna texts, which actually dates long before 600 BC, notes Bethlehem, a town in the land of Jerusalem. So it was not unusual in ancient times to refer to Bethlehem, if you had any reason to refer to it, as a town in the land of Jerusalem.
Okay. If you'd like to hear more about this conversation, please subscribe on our Patreon page at patreon.com/gospeltangents. For just $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview uncut. Also, for our latest updates, go to our facebook.com/gospeltangents page, and you can get those updates as well. Also, we're on Twitter at gospeltangents, so you can see those updates. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Be sure to subscribe on our YouTube page at youtube.com/gospeltangents. And also, if you'd like to get a transcript of this, go to our Gospel Tangents interview page. Just go ahead and do a search for Gospel Tangents, and you should be able to find our page there. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there, and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.